It's time to give your tired old breakfast a wake-up call. At Jack in the Box, I'm introducing a brand new way to breakfast. Jack's Breakfast Pockets for $2 each. Choose between two grilled flour tortilla pockets filled with either ham or sausage, plus freshly cracked eggs and two melty cheeses. It's a hot, delicious breakfast deal. Woo-hoo! And it's just $2. So come try my new breakfast pockets for $2 each, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Backline Report. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres, and every week I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you this week?
I'm great, Carlos. We've got a lot of golf to talk about tonight, but the President's Cup just kind of did not live up to its hype, I'm afraid. The 2017 PGA Tour is officially over. The New York makes a nice backdrop for a golf tournament, but the golf course and the international team weren't up to the challenge, I'm afraid. So tonight we're going to talk about, well, it was a laugher for the U.S. team dominating the internationals in the President's Cup. The Web.com Tour Finals came to an end, and the LPGA nearly gets blown away down under. So we do have a lot of golf to talk about tonight. So, Carlos, let's get to it. Let's go.
Let's get to it, and we have our VIG, very important guest of the week. He's Derek Brody. He's the club professional there at Inverness, and Fred has a great interview with him. You don't want to miss it. But let's start with the weekend backspin. And, Fred, wow, the President's Cup. There was so much. I mean, we talked about it last week. It wasn't – well, I'll let you go to it, and then afterwards – and we have plenty to talk about it, and then I'll add something at the end. So how about that win, or should we call it thumping, by the U.S. team over the internationals?
Yeah, it was definitely a runaway in New Jersey. It was boring. There was very little drama. The U.S. team won early and often, and it was pretty much over by Saturday evening. The main storylines, which there aren't many, was that three presidents showed up for the opening round on Thursday. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush were on hand to shake hands, pose for selfies, and view the festivities. The New York skyline and Statue of Liberty are beautiful. That's pretty much the storylines, Carlos, right there. As you can see, these main storylines don't include much golf. That's because there was very little of it being played. Evidently, the international team missed the ferry from Manhattan coming over to New Jersey, threw five matches on Thursday, five matches on Friday, and eight matches on Saturday. If you're counting, if you're having trouble adding that up on your fingers and toes, that's 18 matches. The international team just pretty much forgot to show up. By Saturday night, the U.S. led 14.5 to 3.5. 3.5. The international team had only managed to win two of the 18 matches outright and eke out three halves. Either the U.S. team was playing extremely well or the internationals were playing very poorly. Well, it's a little bit of both, I'm afraid. Jason Day, Adam Scott, and Hideki Matsuyama, your guy, were the leaders of the international team, but they weren't doing much leading. They managed a total of, get this, wait for it, 0.5 point over the first 3 days. Three of the biggest names on the international team managed 0.5 point in the team matches. Hideki played with three different partners, Schwartzel, Adam Hadwin, and Johnny Vegas, in three of the first four sessions and managed that 0.5 point. With Hadwin versus the powerhouse, Reed and Spieth, in the Friday PM four ball. That was pretty much the extent of the good things for the international team right there. I mean, that's just one sentence. Jason Day was paired with fellow Aussie Mark Leishman, one of the hottest golfers in the world right now, through the first three sessions, and they lost all three. Jason Day jumped over to Louis Oosthuizen for the Saturday PM four ball, and they lost to Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth. Same held true for Adam Scott, who has not had that great a year. He was 0 for after three losses in team play. On the other hand, everything that Captain Steve Stricker tried worked perfectly. Well, he didn't do so much, if you ask him. He asked the players who they wanted to be paired with and just got out of their way. Spieth and Reed earned 3.5 points in 4 games. They earned as many points as the whole international team earned just by themselves, continuing their strong partnership from the Ryder Cup. Justin Thomas and Ricky Fowler racked up 2.5 points in 3 matches. Then Thomas paired with Daniel Berger to win another point on Saturday in the four ball. Phil Mickelson requested rookie Kevin Kisner, and they added 2.5 points in their 3 matches. Kuchar was paired with Dustin Johnson in foursomes, and they won both matches that they played in. Then Dustin Johnson jumped to Brooks Koepka for the four ball, and they won 2 more points for the America team. Johnson was a perfect 4-0 after the first 4 sessions. Daniel Berger and Brooks Koepka lost to South Africans Brandon Grace and Louis Oosthuizen in the first session of foursomes on Thursday, and Kevin Chappell and Charlie Hoffman lost to Anirban Lahiri and Siwoo Kim on Saturday. That was the 2 big wins for the international team. Those 2 wins plus 3 halves total 3.5 points that the internationals earned in the team matches. By Saturday night, the U.S. had an insurmountable 14.5 to 3.5 lead and only needed a single point in singles on Sunday to win the cup. The internationals did win 6.5 points in singles, but the final day was anticlimactic, and it appeared the U.S. team had, you know, just kind of maybe let down a bit, like it was already over and there was no big deal. Plus, and this was just, you know, maybe for casual golf fans, they didn't catch this, but anybody that knew anything, Stricker front-loaded his schedule with the rookies, while Price put his best at the top. You know, even so, the internationals only won 2 of the first 4 matches, and Chappell was able to get a half versus Leishman in the first match out. At the end of the day, though, Jason Day, Hideki, Charles Schwartzel, Louis Oosthuizen, Adam Scott, and Johnny Vegas won 4 points in singles, with Leishman, Grace, and Lahiri earning halves. So the final tally was 19-11, but it was much worse than that score would indicate. There was never a doubt, and the internationals just were never in it. As I mentioned, a bunch of ex-presidents did show up, plus Donald Trump made an appearance on Sunday for a few picks to help award the trophy. Personally, though, Carlos, I think he just wanted to get a closer look at the players' wives and girlfriends, which I can't blame him for that. Seriously, though, did you see the video of Donald congratulating U.S. team? And they doffed their hats and, you know, shook hands. You know, that's how golfers are taught. The manners and respect for opponent as well as authority, that's one of the things I dearly love about golf, Carlos. Ernie Els spouted off a little bit after the competition was over. Ernie's, it's touted that he's going to be the next international captain. He wants to change his selection process, give the captain more leeway in choosing his team and play fewer matches so the internationals can hide the weaker players to compete with a much deeper American squad. Is this a preview of things? So also, with the strength of the American team are these young guys, and we're going to talk more about that later when we wrap up the year here, but is this a preview of things to come for America's team in Ryder Cup and President's Cup? Was this the best American team in years, maybe ever? That's pretty strong. Phil Mickelson is now the leader in points for both teams with a 26-16-13 career record in President's Cup. I don't know if they can hold the President's Cup without Phil Mickelson being in it. I don't think it's possible. Did you like – Carlos, I'm going to ask you just straight out. Did you like Liberty National Golf Club, or were you able to watch much of it? The first hole has to be the worst designed golf hole in America or possibly the world. Nearly half the players, and these are some of the best players in the world, found that creek with their tee shots. You know, you can blame it on nerves or prevailing wind, whatever, that nearly made the hole unplayable, but that should not be there. That is just idiotic to make the opening hole like that. If I were playing that golf course, I'd never go back. I would not play it. That was just totally stupid. Then some of the other shots that guys would hit in the greens, they were so severe, and the runoffs, and, you know, they put the pins on those hills. It looks about like a putt-putt golf course. I mean, the only thing missing is a clown's mouth. I did not care for Liberty National. And as I remember, I didn't like it when they played the tournament there that, a couple of years ago. So when they played the FedEx Cup tournament there. So Carlos, I'll just ask you, what did you think of Liberty National? Did you get a chance to look at it?
Yeah, I did. And it's just that it was such a beating that these guys were giving. That it wasn't really an issue. It's just like you said, to me, well, yeah, it's a golf course that has a great backdrop. I mean, having the Statue of Liberty on the back and the Manhattan skyline and all that, so it makes for a good place to go. But as a golfer, I think it shouldn't, I have to agree with you, it shouldn't have been for this kind of a competition, definitely. But anyway, it didn't matter. I mean, the beating that the U.S. was giving was such an impressive outing, and the internationals were just not giving anything to them. And we talked about this last week. I mean, they had one of the weakest teams ever that we have seen from the internationals. And the worst thing was that none of them, it's not that they cannot play, it's just that none of them, only we said it that it was Mark Leishman, the only person, the only player that was playing some kind of decent going into the President's Cup. So definitely, to the statement that you say that if this would be the best team ever, I cannot say that, because what did they face? I mean, anybody would have beaten them the way that they did. So that for now. I have another comment that I want to ask you afterwards, after you wrap up what you're reporting.
Well, the only thing I got to wrap up here with, Carlos, is that I watched a little bit at the end as it was getting over there, and I have to give major props to Daniel Berger's girlfriend, Victoria Slater. He is definitely an overachiever. I was kind of surprised that Polina Gretzky was standing beside Slater, because Slater makes Paulina look average. So, I don't think Paulina likes that. So, she is a beautiful young woman. Daniel Berger gets a big thumbs up for me on that. And that's what I have to wrap up with, Carlos, right there. For me, that was the highlight of the whole 4 days right there.
See, when you talk about that, about being the highlight, that speaks volume about the quality of golf that we saw. I mean, and also when everybody's talking about Donald Trump celebrating with the wives and girlfriends, and when everybody's talking about three presidents were there on Thursday, what about golf? What happened there during that week? I don't know if this bodes well for the future of the President's Cup, because I don't remember. I mean, I was just on the weekend. I didn't watch anything on Saturday. On Sunday, I just wanted to go through to see what was going on, if the internationals would pull out the miracle. But definitely, like you said, Stricker just backloaded his roster, and Nick Price did it the other way. So that's why they looked like they were making an advance, but everybody knew that they were not gonna win. So I don't know. It doesn't bode well for the President's Cup future to me, and also with regards to the viewership. I mean, it was horrible, the ratings for this President's Cup. It really,
who's gonna watch it? Even with people boycotting the NFL on Sunday, they're not gonna watch this stuff. It was awful.
That is the thing. That was exactly where I was gonna go. I mean, there was people that are right now, like you're saying, following President Trump's boycott, and they weren't even watching that. So who was watching? That's the thing. There was no drama. It was over. I would say on Friday night it was over. Saturday, it was just a mere, let's play this two sessions and let's see what happens. But everybody was knowing what was going to happen. There was nothing to expect. The Americans right now, and I don't like the way that the President's Cup is going, or even how it's done, because the international is contrary to Europe when you play the Ryder Cup. Yeah, I know the argument that Ryder Cup has a lot of years more history than what the President's Cup has. But, hey, there have been already 9 sessions of this in 10. And it's the same thing. The U.S. keeps winning and winning and winning. And there's no continuity between the international players. The U.S., like you mentioned last week when you were doing the preview for the U.S. team, they're guys that go hang out, they go out to eat, they know each other, they have friendships, they have follow-up after this. But the internationals are just people from Canada, from Japan, from India, Venezuela, Argentina, Australia. They don't have anything in common. They don't play together. They're not even from the same place. Even when you see Mark Leishman, Jason Day, and Adam Scott, they don't hang out together, and they are all from Australia. So there's a lot of change. I know that Ernie Els says that he wants to change the way that the selection process is, but I don't think the problem is the selection. I think the problem is just the opposite. It's the way that those international players are. And I cannot say that happens. If it would be the same way in the women's, the U.S. would never win one. Because internationals and the women's, it's completely the opposite. South Korea alone can have a team.
They would beat everybody. You have 10 South Koreans on the team.
they can beat alone. Add to that three more players. You had Adia Yutanagan, you had Lydia Ko, and you had Brooke Henderson. Unbeatable.
Yeah.
That team is going to be unbeatable.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no way you beat an international team. So it's not about a problem about being internationals. It's how they are approaching this on the men's side. So, I think they have to really rethink everything. It's not only the selection process. Hopefully we'll see some improvements on this. I don't think it's impossible, but there has to be a lot to do there to make this at least something watchable or something that people are going to be expecting to go and see it.
Yeah, just a couple points, Carlos. They did win. The only President's Cup that the International has ever won was at Royal Melbourne, and that's where we're going back to in 2 years. The only thing about that team, I think about 6 of them were from Australia back then. So they really had a common theme on that team. The guys all knew each other really well. I think it was a fairly good deal. And if we go back in history, I always like to go back in history. Have we seen this before? Well, we have seen it before back in the Ryder Cup, back in the 60s, when the U.S. team would just kill Great Britain and Ireland every time until Jack suggested, hey, you're a European tour, bring Europe in, you get longer, you get savvy, you make the team a lot better and it's more competitive. And that's what's happened. And so it took really about 15 years, though, for that team to gel. If you remember, they didn't really start winning until, the mid-80s is when they finally started being competitive and the matches became very close. So, but I know it's a different deal, too. The European Tour, those guys have hung out together. They grew up together. They played junior golf together over there in Europe. So that's a different deal than what the internationals are dealing with, where everybody comes from a different place. I think you had three South Africans. You had a couple Australians on the team. And then everybody else was from all around the world. So, it's difficult to get the guys together even to have a meeting. You have to do it at a major or one of the WGC events where all the guys are in there at the same time. So it's a different deal. And just a real quick word about the process that Ernie talks about. I think Nick Price tried this too after his first time as a President's Cup captain. And Fincham and the PGA Tour just shot him down like real quick. And so maybe Monahan will take a little different look at it. I don't know. I really do think they need to change it because the U.S. team is so much deeper. They need to limit the matches a little bit. We've said this before, Carlos. They don't need to go 4 days. They only need to go Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They can play 4 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon on both Friday and Saturday, which would only demand 8 players out every time. So that would leave 4 guys sitting. And so you could kind of hide your rookies or your weaker players, your guys who weren't playing well or were injured or sick or whatever, and just put your stronger players out, and that would negate some of the depth that the U.S. team enjoys in the President's Cup. I know they don't want to match or mirror the Ryder Cup. I'm sure that's part of the deal. They have a build different formats in the Ryder Cup, and they like that. But, you know, maybe you go something like the Walker Cup does and play foursomes in the morning and singles in the afternoon or something. I don't know. And maybe limit the singles not to everybody, just maybe like 8 singles matches so you can sit some guys. But there's a lot of different things they could do. But I don't know. The PGA Tour was not interested in doing that, about 4 years ago. Whether they will now or not, they're going to do something because their product is going to suffer. Nobody's going to watch it, and their sponsors are going to dry up.
Yeah, and that's the point that I think with the Ryder Cup, like you're saying, it took a while for it to really the Europeans get on it and the winning wagon. But I don't think nowadays people. Since there's so much exposure on TV, not only TV but social media and everything else, everything is watched everywhere. So I don't think there's that patience from the people to wait to see if this changes in 20 years and the internationals are going to be competitive then. But hey, it makes for a good point to discuss what has to be done, and I think we will take a full show to discuss all that. Anyway,
maybe we need some smarter guys than you and me to come up with the answers on this one, Carlos. I don't know.
They need some degrees and all that stuff in this. But anyway, it's good to see the U.S. team looking as strong as it is, because we know that the Europeans next year are coming back with a vengeance, and they're going to have a great team as well. So it bodes well for a great Ryder Cup. I just can't wait to see how this is going to fare next year. So anyway, let's move on now to the LPGA. And I have to say that after all that she had been forced to contend with, to say that Brooke Henderson was happy, that was an understatement. The Canadian young gun was crowned champion of the inaugural LPGA Tour event on Kiwi soil on Monday, sealing the New Zealand Women's Open title by 5 shots in strong westerly winds at the Windcross Farm course near Auckland. On what was the 5th day of the tournament, after heavy rain squalls and high winds meant the final round could not be completed on Sunday, the 20-year-old world number 12 set out with a 4-shot lead and 12 holes to complete. It was an advantage she would not relinquish to secure the $195,000 winner's check. With a tournament total of 17 under par, China's Jin Yang claiming outright second on 12 under, and South Korea's Hee Young Park a further one back in third, and American Jennifer Song, who continues her streak of good finishes with a solo fourth. Kiwi star Lydia Ko had a double bogey, triple bogey finish, resulting in a 3-over-75 final round, which saw her sole even host fall down to the leaderboard and end up in a tie for 22nd. Chaos had ensued with the resumption in play with the New Zealand's Women Open that happened about 4:50 p.m. when another squall hit the Windcross Farm course and resulted in hoarding flying across the course in combination with some player angst. I mean, after lighting up the Ling-style layout at Ardmore across the first 2 days, third-round leader Belen Mozo was captured on video demonstrating to an official that, hey, we're like sheep out here. In Sky Television, contractors slipped down a bank, which required a stretcher taken onto the course as a precaution by the ambulance. I mean, it was that tough. She also faded in the often brutal spring conditions to a card 6-over final round and finished in a tie for 5th at 9-under with fellow countrywoman Beatrice Ricari and Australian Sue Oh. Rounding up the top 10 in the finish were in a tie for 8 were Americans Brittany Lincecum, Cheyenne Woods, Lindy Duncan, along with Madeline Sackstrom and Nicole Brock Larson. You know, while most players struggled, there were few such struggles for Brooke Henderson. And after being draped in the Kotawai, which is the traditional Maori cloak,
next to the 18th green, where she had sealed a commanding win with a birdie, the affable Canadian said that she felt amazing. It was always going to be the one who handled the mentality testing wind and rain best that would likely prevail. And Henderson was that person in carding an impressive 3-under, 69 round to go with rounds of 65, 70, and 67 across the first 3 days. Understandably, she was very proud of how, with a lot of help from older sister and caddy Brittany, she had handled probably the worst conditions she had played in, and that's how she called them. With most of the cards in her favor as she stood on the 7th green when play resumed on Monday, Henderson was just a solid final 12 holes away in the increasingly blustery conditions from securing the crown. A bogey 5 at the tricky 8th hole may have brought on a few nerves, but the fact that Brittany Lincecum had double bogey the 7th and Mosso had done the same at the 8th meant that her advantage was still comfortable. She got her round immediately back on track with 4 straight pars, and when she made birdie at the par 3 13th to stretch her buffer to 6 shots with 6 holes to play, the title was all but in her grasp. Bogey at the par 4 16th was a minor misstep, but the second youngest major winner in women's golf history, behind only Lydia Ko, ensured the Kiwi fans got a fitting finish, nailing her approach at the par 5 last to 5 feet and then draining the birdie putt. Other notable finishers, Katrina Mathieu at T17. As I mentioned before, Lydia Ko was at T22. Danielle Kang, who was playing with Stevie Williams on the bag, finished T24, along with, among others, Jody Iwashadov. And Fred Emily K. Peterson was among the notables that missed the cut in the New Zealand Open.
Well, Stevie won't stand for his personal, you know, the baggage. He won't stand for a 24th place finish. That'll never go for Stevie. He's got something new there. Hey, the Web.com Tour Championship was held last weekend in Atlantic Beach, Florida. Final event of the year. 25 new cards were issued for the PGA Tour next year. Sam Saunders, now 30 years old, a resident of Atlantic Beach and a member of the Atlantic Beach Golf Club, made 6 consecutive birdies on the back 9 to fire a 59 in the opening round on Thursday. Saunders added rounds of 66, 70, 69 to finish at 20 under par for the week, was runner-up and moved up to 6th on the Web.com Tour Finals money list to secure to return to the PGA Tour for next year. 5-time PGA Tour winner Jonathan Bird is headed back from the PGA Tour, but his wife had to give him a little attitude adjustment last week. After being up and down between the minor PGA Tour events and the Web.com Tour the past couple of years, plus missing his last 2 cuts, he was not too excited to head to Atlantic Beach for the Web.com Tour Championship. But his wife got his head right. You know, wives are kind of good at that, Carlos. I don't know if you've ever had that problem, but you know, I've been there a time or two. She told him to pick up his lip and fight it out. None of this hangdog stuff around here. Get your ass in gear and get out there and make some money. Well, Bird also gave credit for his good week to his caddy who lives in Atlantic Beach and had the local knowledge. He also got to put on putt on the Bermuda greens that augmented his attitude. And he led the field in scrambling, was 3rd in putting average, and he just liked the golf course. It fitted his eye. Heavy rains in Atlantic Beach caused a postponement of the final round and moved to a Monday. In total, 5 players, Jonathan Bird, Stefani, Matt Jones, Cameron Tregale, and Tom Hoge, all entered the week outside the top 25 in the finals money list, but jumped into the top 25 with strong finishes to secure their tour card. So, Carlos, Web.com Tour is over, but it didn't finish up till Monday night. A bunch of them are playing in the Safeway Open this week in California. So they had to get from Florida, the east coast of Florida, to California. That's pretty much across the United States. Somehow on Tuesday, they got Wednesday, and they tee it up Friday or Thursday morning. So short week for the new PGA Tour pros heading out to California.
Well, they know that the big boys are not playing, so they say, let's try to get a win and some early FedEx Cup points early before they start playing. So, yeah, I would do that trip if I were in their shoes. Anyway, let's talk about the European Tour, where Paul Dunn held his nerve to survive a late surge from Rory McIlroy in the British Masters at close house. The Irishman birdied the last two holes to win by three strokes and claim a maiden European Tour victory. On a day of low scoring at close house, Rory McIlroy was looking for a first victory in 2017, but he got off to a slow start on Sunday with five straight pars. A birdie on the sixth got him moving in the right direction, but he was set back with a bogey on the 11th. His round came to life on the run for home and made a run at the title with five birdies on the last six holes. I mean, he closed with a 63 and posted a clubhouse total of 17 under par, which looked good, but at that stage, Dunn had a one-shot lead with two holes to play. He made a birdie at the 17th to increase the cushion to two over McIlroy with just a par three last to play, and he then sealed the tournament victory with a chip in from off the last green. Dunn closed with a sensational 61 to finish on 20 under par with McIlroy in solo second. 48-year-old Robert Carlsen carded a closing 66 to end the week in third with Florian Fritz, David Lingmerth, and local boy Graham Storm tie for fourth. It was an important week for Robert Carlsen and Florian Fritz. I mean, the Swede led with 18 holes to play, and he fired a creditable 66 to win the week in third spot, starting the tournament in 164th place on the Race to Dubai standings. He's now up to 98th. The top 100 will keep their playing rights for 2018. Fritz, who has a fear of flying and can only play a limited schedule as a result, climbed from outside the top 150 to 114th, and both will be playing this week's Dunhill Links in Scotland. So they are very, very much into that race. Other notable finishers, Shane Lowry finishes solo seventh, Lucas Berger-Gard, who had won the Portugal Masters the week earlier, finished tied for seventh with Tyrrell Hatton and Richie Ramsey to round up the top 10. Matthew Fitzpatrick and Ian Poulter finished T11. Tournament host Lee Westwood finished T15. Martin Kaymer, T20. Alex Levy and Graham McDowell, T45. Danny Willett, T57. And among the notables to miss the cut were Sergio Garcia, Bernd Wiesberger, Eduardo Molinari, Russell Knox, the defending champion Alex Noren, and golf's most interesting man, Miguel Angel Jimenez. It was the first European Tour for Dunn, who led the 2015 Open Championship through 54 holes when he was still an amateur. He's a 24-year-old now and a winner on the European Tour. You might remember he lost a playoff earlier this year for the Trophée Hassan II, but he made no mistakes this time, producing a tremendous final round to hold off the four-time major champion Rory McIlroy. The Irishman has now climbed to 12th place on the Race to Dubai and into the top 100 on the official World Golf Rankings. And one of the differences that you can see as he is continuing his progression is that he has gotten tougher mentally. He admitted afterwards going out to win the tournament rather than have someone hand it over to him. And he was pleased and relieved that he proved to himself that he can get it done, no pun intended. Fred, another name from the European Tour that we will have to keep an eye on, that's Paul Dunn.
Yeah, I got to watch the end of that, and he had the lead teeing off there at 18 on the par 3, and he came out of his tee shot and pushed it to the right. I thought he was going to go in a bunker, but he actually landed in the grass, in a grass strip between two bunkers to the right of the green. And he had a pretty difficult chip, really. It was not that easy of a chip. The green kind of sloped away from him a little bit. He had to go over a little bit of a mound. And it was in some thick grass. And he opened his, it must have been like a 60 degree, and slid under that thing kind of like a bunker shot, threw it up in the air, and it just went up there and just went straight into the hole. I mean, it wasn't even a lip in. It just went straight in for the birdie and ended up with a three-shot win. Rory was watching in the scores tent to make sure that he didn't have to go out for a playoff. But Really good win for Paul Dunn. It was fun to watch. Hey, Carlos, I don't know if you had anything on Sumatra Tour. I have it here. I was just going to do that real quick before I go into the last thing. Hannah Green from Australia completed a wire-to-wire victory on Monday at the IOA Golf Classic at and she carded a final round 269 to win by two strokes. That's her third Sumatra Tour victory of the season. She pockets $22,500 and gets her card automatically. So she was going to be in the top 10 anyhow. She was going to get her card after next week. Sumatra Tour Championship, but she won this week for a third win of the year and goes directly to the LPGA Tour for next year. The USGA held its final state team competition last week. Three teenagers from Tennessee, Riley Rennell, Jana Choi, and Ashley Gillum, combined to shoot 1 under par 143 in the final round to win the 12th and final USGA Women's State Team Championship on the club at Las Campanas Sunrise Course. Due to heavy rains, round two was completed in the morning after the course received 1.5 inches of rain on Wednesday. The course was made playable. Round two resumed at 7:10. They got that finished off, and the final round began at 9:15 on both sides. So the USGA State Team Championships began in 1995 as part of the Association's Centennial Celebration. They were conducted on a biennial basis in 2010, but they're going to be done with that. They're just not going to do them anymore. This is the last year for it. So these teenagers from Tennessee get to have the honor of being the final state women's amateurs for the USGA. So, Carlos, that wraps up what I have for the backspin.
And that wraps up our week in backspin. And now it's time to take a look ahead with the four call and what is going to be playing this weekend. There's not much action, but the PGA Tour and the European Tour have action on it. And Fred, the Safeway Open, the new season of the PGA Tour starts with a quick turnaround. Just 4 days after 50 players earn the PGA Tour cards through the Web.com Tour Finals.
Yeah, I'm kind of taking a break here, Carlos. I mean, this is the off season right now. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So, did you notice that? I hope you don't miss it because it is only 3 days long. 2017 is officially over, and 2018, as you say, begins on Thursday at Johnny Miller's Silverado Golf Club in Napa Valley. Bet they're going to have some good wine on tap out there. It's a par 72, about just under 7,200 yards. There's 144 players in the field. Brennan Steele is a defending champion. It's a $6 million purse with $1.08 million going to the winner. This is the fifth year. It's the fifth year already for the wraparound schedule, Carlos. So here we go. It's only 183 days until the Masters, Carlos.
That's the highlight, right? I mean, there's nothing else we can talk about this. It's just that, hey, the Masters is only 180 days away. Let's talk about the European Tour, where the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship, with its unique blend of fiercely competitive European Tour golf and celebrity spotting, returns this week to three celebrated link courses, which is St. Andrews Old Course, Carnoustie, and Kings Barns. The tournament is a pro-am with the format based on the long-running U.S. PGA Tour's AT&T Pebble Beach National Pro-Am, has been held annually since 1937, except during the Second World War, where each team consists of one amateur and one professional. The purse will be over 4 million euros with a winning prize of 676,133. The defending champion is Tyrrell Hatton, who last year stormed to his maiden European Tour title last year with a four-shot victory following a stunning weekend performance over the St. Andrews Old Course. He carded a course record equaling 62, courtesy of 10 birdies at the home of golf on moving day, to storm three clear of the field heading into day four. Rory McIlroy is making his last start of the year and returns for the first time in 3 years, as he has finished second here three times, including in his most recent appearance in 2014, takes to three of Scotland's most famous link courses along his father, Jerry. after a second place finish at the British Masters, supported by Sky Sports, behind Paul Dunne, who is also in the field this week. Rory headlines a strong field, and I'm sorry about my voice, I'm losing it, which includes the Race to Dubai leader Tommy Fleetwood, who's returning to the fairways for the first time since the birth of his son Franklin. Defending champion Hatton enters the week in strong form after an impressive performance at last week's British Masters. McIlroy will be joined by four fellow world number ones in Luke Donald, Ernie Els, Martin Kaymer, and Lee Westwood, while three more major champions join this luminaries of the game in the shape of Paddy Harrington, who is the only two-time winner of this tournament since it began in 2001, Paul Laurie and Graham McDowell. Fred, the field also includes Brendan Grace, who just competed in the President's Cup last week, and J.B. Holmes, who is playing on a sponsor's exemption.
Yeah, this is always a lot of fun to watch on TV because you see, get to see these great courses, Kings Barnes and St. Andrews. I always like that. Plus, a lot of celebs play with the pros that go over for the week, and usually you get some windy, cold, rainy weather, so that's always a lot of fun. Hey, Carlos, the LPGA Tour is off this week. They played in New Zealand last week. They're off this week, and they're heading up to Asia. But we've got action on the Sumatra Tour. As I mentioned, this is the final week. It's the Sumatra Tour Championship this week. 10 LPGA Tour cards for next year will be handed out on Sunday. Five players have already secured a spot for that to keep their cards. The bottom six play, the bottom five, Lindsay Weaver, Ann Catherine Tangay, Yu Liu, Caitlin Dambaugh, and Emma Talley still have some work to do. They have to play pretty decent, make the cut, and play decent this week to stay in the top 10. In reality, numbers 11 through 23 still have a chance. The prize money is enough. If they, as a farther down, they're going to have to win or finish really high to jump up, but it's possible. And so there is quite a bit of competition that will be going on at the Sumatra Tour Championship this week. There's going to be 108 players in the field. It's a $200,000 purse, $30,000 to the winner. So that's not just chicken feed. So we're going to have 10 new LPGA Tour players coming off the Sumatra Tour Championship this week. And also the Champions Tour is off until next week, Carlos. So, Carlos, I hope everyone is reading the new Ohio Golf Journal. It's loaded with timely golf news and information, plus tips, travel, and opinion. The October issue will be hitting email inboxes next week. You can visit ohiogolfjournal.com today to view the September issue and sign up to receive your free copy via your email. Check out Ohio Golf Journal for great golf news and information. Carlos.
And with that, we wrap up our four-call or quick previews of this weekend's action. Now let's go to the Par 5 news. And, Fred, you have some news about Rory McIlroy.
Yeah, we kind of alluded to it early. He's going to play this week, and he really just played last week in the British Masters and this week to make sure he had his mandatory 12 events on the European Tour so he didn't create any controversy next year for the Ryder Cup team. But he really has not been feeling well. He's been playing with less than perfect health and still managed the runner-up last week at the British Masters. He's got 64-63 on the weekend. That's not too snotty. He's let it be known, though, that beginning once this week is over, he's going to be undergoing a complete medical examination to determine, you know, what's bothering him. Maybe they're going to check the air in the tires and get an oil change while he's at it. Rory said, there have been times when my joints have been inflamed or my energy level's low, so I will be doing lots of different stuff, including blood and allergy tests. I need to find out what's better and how I can be more disciplined, maybe in his diet or whatever. After that, he's going to head to Dubai for 4 weeks of rehab, so he probably won't hit any balls until the end of November. It's vital that he uses these weeks to improve his game and his health. I need to be ready to start next year in a much better place than this year. As I mentioned, Rory's even checking his eating habits. He's concerned with joint muscle pain. Plus, he's feeling fatigued. McIlroy admitted he made a mistake in playing in the U.S. Open in June when he was not fully fit and missed the cut. He said, if I had to do it all over again, I would not play. Rory really feels if he takes care of his body now and finds out what's causing his physical problems, he can make the next 10 years his best and challenge Tiger and Jack's records. We just want to see him get to the point where he can join Justin, Jordan, and Dustin to make the pro game even more interesting. Can you imagine with what we've got going on now with Justin and Jordan, and throw in Dustin Johnson in there, and then if you bring in Rory, that's a big four. Now you got something going, man. That would be a lot of fun to have those guys battling for majors and the WGCs and the big events next year, Carlos.
Oh, it would, and I would add to that some other players like Jason Day that should be in full force next year. So it will be a very interesting we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, don't give it away. Don't give it away.
No. Sorry about that. I got a little ahead there. But hey, Fred, have you ever wondered, where should I go to eat when I'm in Conway, Arkansas? Have you? I mean, who has?
I have not done that recently, actually, Carlos. But next time I'm in Conway, Arkansas, I will ask that question.
Well, let me tell you that John Daly has a suggestion. The John Daly Steakhouse. Okay. The first John Daly Steakhouse has opened in central Arkansas, according to the golfer who lent his name to the eatery. The 51-year-old two-time major champion revealed this week on social media that his eponymous eatery was open for business. The restaurant is located at 912 Front Street in Conway, which is less than an hour from his home in Dardanelle, Arkansas, and it opened to the public Wednesday for lunch. The location's Facebook page shows its hours as 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. for lunch and 4:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. for dinner from Monday through Saturday. The restaurant concept is built around the career of the famous golfer, but he's not actively involved in the construction process. When you get there, you can have the Big John Steakhouse Burger topped with charred onions and fried egg. I like that one already. And wash it down with a John Daly Sweet Tea Lemonade Vodka. I'll take something else. But the restaurant has a nice touch to it, too, you know, as the place includes a golf club chandelier. I saw the picture, and it was really nice. I mean, two additional locations have been proposed out of a planned 10 over the next 5 years in Little Rock and Northwest Arkansas. Daly was born in Carmichael, California, but he developed Arkansas ties while living in Dardanelle during a portion of his childhood and later attending the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville. Anyway, Fred, this is far from Daly's first foray into business. Time will tell how this goes, but it's likely to be his most delicious at the moment.
I hope he has nothing to do with the management or the running of the operation and cannot put his hands on the money. Just use his name and let him visit, drink a few beers, and then usher him out. Don't let him get sloppy drunk. Don't let the police have to come, I hope it works out well for him. Carlos, the Rookie of the Year and Player of the Year nominees were announced. But as you and I both know, this is just kind of a formality. These are not going to be close at all. Following Sunday's conclusion of the Tour Championship and the FedEx Cup Playoffs, nominees for the PGA Tour Player of the Year and PGA Tour Rookie of the Year were finalized by the Tour Player Directors and members of the Player Advisory Council. The nominee for the Jack Nicklaus Award as the PGA Tour Player of the Year are Dustin Johnson, Hideki Matsuyama, Jordan Spieth, and Justin Thomas. Nominees for Rookie of the Year are Wesley Bryan, Patrick Kammy, Mackenzie Hughes, Grayson Murray, and Xander Schauffele.
Fred,
they're determined. Fred, yes.
Before you continue, finish and then I'll tell you. And I'm sorry for interrupting. I thought it would be better, but no, finish and then I'll tell you. No
problem. It's not going to take me long because I know exactly what you're thinking. But the awards excuse me, are determined by a number of votes, and they have to have played at least 15 official money events during the season, and the voting will close on Monday, October 2nd, which was yesterday. So the winners are going to be announced here real quick. So you got Dustin Johnson, who's 33. I'm going to talk more about him later, but he had a scoring average of 69.5, had 8 top 10 finishes. Not only that, Hideki Matsuyama, we know, had a great year. Jordan Spieth had a great year. But Justin Thomas, let me tell you, he won 5 times. 5 times. Plus, one of those was a major, and he won the FedEx Cup, the $10 million. So, Carlos, I'm pretty sure Justin Thomas is going to be named Player of the Year. And then, for the Rookie of the Year, you got Wesley Bryan, Patrick Cantlay, Mackenzie Hughes, Grayson Murray, and Xander. And Xander is coming off winning the FedEx Cup, and you can throw in that he won the Greenbrier. Plus, he was a T5 at the U.S. Open, so I think I'm just going to take a guess here, but I got a feeling Xander Schauffele is going to be named the Rookie of the Year. Now, do you disagree with that, Carlos?
No, I don't. I mean, why should I? I mean, just to add to that, he was just named officially the PGA Tour Rookie of the Year, so that is official. Right now, it was mentioned. So,
I was watching for it today and didn't see it. So yeah.
No, it was just came out a few minutes ago. So he definitely was the Rookie of the Year just an hour ago. It was published. But my question is, why John Rahm isn't in that?
Technically, he is not a rookie. He had enough starts, enough stuff last year. That technically he was not a rookie this year.
So he had more than 15 last year?
It's not 15. It's how many cuts you make or something like that, how many starts. He had enough starts last year. I think it's 5. I think it's only 5 maybe. Have to look that up. I don't have the exact answer. But he had enough stuff last year that he was or he made enough money – he made enough money last year to get his card, right? Yeah,
yes,
he didn't go to Q school or anything. And so I think he had enough starts between his 6 sponsors exemptions, and then once he got his full membership, that he made more starts in the fall or whatever. Well, no, the fall was next year. Anyhow, he did not qualify as a true rookie this year. That's
because he had 7 starts. He played 7 times last year. That I can tell you. He won $1 million, $4,000 last year. He made 6 cuts. So if it's 5, like you say, then yes, that would be it. But I thought it was more. So that's why I was trying to find out what the criteria was, because otherwise – it doesn't matter what Xander Schauffele would have done. It wouldn't have been a contest either. But anyway, I mean, Xander Schauffele definitely was a runaway after what he did there at the Tour Championship. I think it was close. I always, as you all heard me all year long, I was calling John Rahm the Rookie of the Year. I mean, easy for me. But then now when I saw the names, of course, after seeing what Schauffele did on the Tour Finals, well, it was going to be really difficult. It was close, I think, before that. Because it was anybody's game, really, before Schauffele really sealed it with that win. There was only 2 players that made the Tour Championship, which was Xander and Patrick Cantlay. And you can make a case for those two, but even Wesley Bryan played very well as well. So it was going to be close if Xander wouldn't have done what he did. But definitely he's a good-looking rookie. I mean, a great deserving winning rookie, but next year is going to be really, really good for him, and I can't wait to see him play. Hey,
I will when we play the interview later on the VIG, I will try and look that up and see if I get an answer for you on that, Carlos. They addressed that just over the last couple of weeks on the broadcast on TV. And I know we've been talking about Rahm being a rookie all year, which I thought he was also because he just got his card based off of his starts last year. So I don't know why he wouldn't be a rookie, but there was some technicality that he was not truly a rookie officially.
Okay, no problem. Hey, let's talk a little bit about Gil Hans. He has a knack for finding potential in desolate, overgrown areas. When Rich Mack, the CFO of the Mosaic Company, approached him 2 years ago about designing a third course at the Streamsong Resort, Hans accepted the challenge. Streamsong already featured a pair of courses, the Red and Blue, that rank among the best in the country. But Hans was a course architect who designed the Olympic Golf Course in Rio de Janeiro, wanted to craft an experience. So along with partner Jim Wagner, he wanted to put golfers on a course that took time to figure out. Hey, it did that on the Olympic Golf Course for sure. He wanted people to learn and adapt as they step back on the course. He wanted them to like it more the second time around. Standing outside of the newly built clubhouse on Monday, Hans was able to watch that vision become reality as the Black Course debuted. Joining the Red and Blue courses, the former designed by Tom Doak and the latter by Bill Kaur and Brent Crenshaw, the Black provides a new corner to the expansive resort of Mulberry and west of Fort Meade. Along with the golf, a new and minimalist clubhouse designed by Tampa architects Albert and Carlos Alfonso, it sits atop a hill. The clubhouse restaurant Bone Valley Tavern is elegantly simple in its own right and filled with natural light coming from the many windows that wrap around the building. This just seems to be another hit for Gil Hans and definitely one that is going to be worth watching or at least visiting to see. If it's like he says, maybe it wouldn't be enough to visit it once. You're going to have to visit it twice or three times to enjoy it even more and more. But another piece of golf course news, a plan for an 18-hole links golf course in Sutherland costing up to £10 million is due to be submitted to the Highland Council. The course proposed for Cole Links near Embell has been opposed by conservation groups including the Scottish Wildlife Trust, RSPB Scotland, and Bug Life. The developers, who include U.S. businessman and Embell Trust, said they had revised their plan to reduce its impact on a protected area. If planning permission is granted, work on the course could start next year. But part of the course will be inside the Lochfleet site of special scientific interest. But the developers argue that the area involved makes up only 1.8% of that site. U.S. golf course developer Mike Kaiser, businessman Tom Warnock, and landowner Edward Abel Smith and the Embell Trust hope to develop the course. If planning permission is granted, work building the course could potentially start next year, as I said, but conservation groups have warned that the project will destroy rare wildlife habitat. RSPB Scotland said Cole Links was an internationally important downland and was done home to many rare species of wildlife. A spokesman for the RSPB Scotland said that it's part of a coalition along with the Scottish Wildlife Trust, Buglife Scotland, Prentlife Scotland, Butterfly Conservation Scotland, and the Marine Conservation Society, which is opposed to any destruction of this, as they call it, an irreplaceable habitat. Fred, the coalition has been calling on the public to defend Cole Links by contacting the local MSPs and councillors and will study the application in detail once it has been published. So this is definitely one thing that we're going to keep an eye on all of those developments because, as we already know, what happened also on the Olympic golf course when the environmentalists start to go against this could drag on and on and on.
Yeah, but you got to have faith in Kaiser. He normally knows what he's doing, and he'll get it figured out. Carlos, I was reading here in the Sporting News that the only thing they said that Though 2016-17 was John Rahm's first full season on tour, he was not officially labeled as a rookie. After earning his card just last season, thus he was unable to win. Now that sounds like a bunch of hooey to me, but that's what they say. Okay. So moving right along. I don't know why you'd have to be labeled a rookie. I mean, it's clear. I mean, he just got his card last year. This is his first full season. Why isn't he a rookie? I don't know. Anyhow, last week during the President's Cup, former President George W. Bush, who is an honorary chairman of the First Tee, announced that Keith Dawkins would be named the new CEO of the First Tee, replacing Joe Louis Barrows when he retires at the first of the year. Ex-President Bush remarked, "The First Tee is a very effective and very necessary program for our nation's youth and future. I'm proud to be the honorary chairman and to have worked with Joe Barrow, and I thank him for his leadership over the years. I congratulate Keith Dawkins and look forward to working with him. The First Tee and thousands of young people will benefit from his energy and expertise." Dawkins is a 25-year veteran of media and entertainment, most recently serving as executive vice president of Nickelodeon. He will begin at the First Tee on October 16 as incoming CEO. He will officially take the reins upon Barrow's retirement January 1. Dawkins will report to the World Golf Foundation Board and the First Tee Advisory Board. Tim Fincham, who doesn't have much to do anymore and keeps a pretty keen eye on the First Tee, he has a soft place in his heart for that, said, "Keith is a dynamic leader who brings a suite of assets to the position, most notably a proven track record of forming high-level and lasting partnerships, organizational management, and innovation. Is a commitment to diversity and inclusion. I'm thankful for Joe's unwavering commitment to the First Tee over the past 18 years, and I trust the transition of leadership will mean continued momentum for the organization. Carlos, we have had Mr. Barrows on the program in the past, and we will try to get an interview with Mr. Dawkins in the future. I can give you some inside information that some of the insiders of the First Tee, while feeling it is a very worthwhile program and does great work and they love it at the local level, it has become very bloated and top-heavy. Too much of the money is being spent at the top and not getting out to the various local First Tee programs. Hopefully, Mr. Dawkins can address this and make the First Tee even stronger in the future, Carlos."
Definitely. I mean, it was a great, great work that Mr. Lewis did before, and hopefully, you know, this is a very special chapter, the First Tee, and hopefully it keeps growing and growing, and anything that we can do to help, we're here to bring any awareness needed, and hopefully we can get an interview with Mr. Dawkins. With that, we wrap up our Part 5 news, and now we go to our practice range, where every week, Fred and I pick a topic, and each of us take our own shot at it, and this time we're going to take a look back at the recently concluded 2016-17 PGA Tour season that, I mean, it was incredible. I mean, we had a lot of new winners, which we're going to be talking about. And the first question that I have to say, Fred, is, was this 2016-17 PGA Tour season a good year for the PGA Tour?
Well, Carlos, on the whole, I think it was a very good year for the Tour. Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas have kind of set themselves apart as two young guys that are just a little bit better than the rest of the bunch. Hideki had a very good year, but faded kind of later in the year. If Dustin Johnson would not have injured himself at the Masters, he would set to have a monster year. It was still pretty good as it was, but the injury, you know, he lost a month or 5-6 weeks there, and then a couple weeks getting back on form. So he really didn't get back into shape really till right at the PGA Championship. Ricky Fowler continues to be close, but just doesn't win with a consistency that everyone predicted and expected. For the tour purses, they total over $350 million. that are available for the touring pros. And then there's the $65 million that gets spread around in the FedEx Cup playoffs. So the tour does not appear to be having any problem drawing sponsors to the game. I don't know what it's going to be like here in a couple of years when they have to renegotiate these contracts. Hopefully the money still keeps rolling in. But the continuing problems are the decreasing television ratings, although live streaming on various smartphones and other internet devices is pretty strong. And I don't know if you've been noticing, Carlos, I've been watching on my phone and on the internet a little bit over the last few weeks, and there is some pretty strong advertising going on there. And one thing about it, you know, when you're on the internet, you can't fast forward or you can't pause through the commercials and go do something else and come back. I mean, you're stuck there. When you're doing that, you got to watch that commercial. So that's one thing, a positive for advertisers, I would think. You can't run away like you can on TV. So the question is, can Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, Dustin Johnson, and Rory McIlroy bring enough fans to the TV sets to keep the money train rolling? So, Carlos, that's what I'm watching for over the next couple of years. But to answer your question, I think 2017 was a very good year. It was much better than last year. And I know you're going to argue with me when they tried to cram the Olympics in there. As it turned out, I liked the Olympics last year, but it just played too much havoc with the schedule. They're going to have to work that out in three more years when they have the Olympics again. But this year was much more orderly. It was a little easier on the players. They could kind of pick and choose where they're going to play a little bit and spread the year out. Even so, coming off last year, we're seeing a lot of these injuries, nagging injuries that come around because we're playing year-round still. So they're going to have to address that one of these days also, Carlos.
Of course I'm going to disagree with you on that one.
I know. I knew it.
They had to choose. I didn't see much of a difference just because they put the Olympics. But anyway, that's material for another show. But no, it was a very good year, I would say, overall for the PGA Tour. I don't think they grew much. I think it was maybe an even year, even though it was a very entertaining one. We saw four major winners: Sergio Garcia, very unlikely or unexpected, won the Masters for his finally that elusive first major of his career, and it was great to see him, the way that he played it, the way that he won. It was highly watched. He was thrusted into his merchandise was thrusted into the stratosphere right after that. Bruce Koepka won his first tournament, major tournament as well, by winning the U.S. Open, and he did it in a runaway fashion. I mean, he was like a freight train, the way that he overpowered everybody in the course on the U.S. Open. Jordan Spieth won his third major there at the Open, so he's just one away from completing that career Grand Slam. He had a great shot, and everybody was expecting him to do it at the PGA Championship, but it was buddy Justin Thomas who really fittingly won his first major of his career. He capped, I think, his great season with that win there at the PGA Championship. We also had 12 first-time winners. Cody Gribble won the Sanderson Farm Championship. Mackenzie Hughes won the RSM Classic. We had Hudson Swafford won the Career Builder Challenge. John Rahm won the Farmers Insurance Open. Adam Hadwin won the Valspar Championship. Wesley Bryan won the RBC Heritage. Kevin Chappell won the Valero Texas Open. Cameron Smith was part of the team that won the Zurich Classic of New Orleans there with Yonex Bliss. But for Jonas, it was his third. Sander Schauffele won his first at the Greenbrier Classic. As we all know, he won his second at the Tour Championship. Bryson DeChambeau won the John Deere Classic. Grayson Murray, the Barbasol. Chris Stroud won the Barracuda Championship. We saw also Justin Thomas was the winningest one with 5 wins. Hideki Matsuyama and Dustin Johnson won 4. Jordan Spieth won 3 times, and Xander Schauffele and Mark Leishman won 2. Among the players that have the most wins, I would say that over 10 wins, Jordan Spieth was able to win from number 9 to his final win, which was number 10 at the Travelers Championship. 11 at the Open Championship. So he has 11 career wins. And the other one that has more than 10 right now is Sergio Garcia has 10 and Dustin Johnson has 16. So those are the winningest players that won this year. Some about the young guys and the old guys that won, Fred has all the information there.
Well, Carlos, the average age of the winners this season on the PGA Tour was 29. More than half of the events were won by guys under the age of 30. Only 6 tournaments were won by players in their 40s. And of those, Pat Perez, Jason Duffner, and Henrik Stenson are really the only names that kind of matter that we're going to probably still see more wins from them. You know, and maybe Perez may be the most interesting of those 3. He just seems to be kind of a late bloomer and has played his best golf over the past couple of years since returning from shoulder injury. Matt Kuchar will be one of those guys over 40 next year, and he could be a force. He's always consistent, but you know, I've made the statement after the Open Championship that that might just fuel his desire to win more next year. That was a close miss for him, and he did not take that. I think that kind of hurt a little bit. In the over 30, from the 30 to 40 group, they won 17 events in that age group. Only one name sticks out to me, and that's Dustin Johnson. We all know what he did, had a fantastic year. He's one of the most athletic players on tour and has the firepower and the mental game to dominate on tour. So I expect him to do very well next year. Billy Horschel, he's in that group. He won again. And I also like Kevin Kisner. Both these guys are good. Kisner especially is very consistent, but I just don't see him winning in bunches or winning majors. The next couple of years, though, barring any further injury, should be Dustin Johnson's prime. Although there are a host of young guys that will make winning difficult on the PGA Tour. 30 of the 53 PGA Tour events last year were won by players in their 20s. This has to be, I don't know if it's a record or not, but I mean, it's got to be a record. That's a lot.
It was a record this year. It was.
I would think it would be. 23-year-old Justin Thomas had 3 wins by the middle of January with the wraparound season, then added the PGA Championship in August and the Dell Technologies in the FedEx Cup playoffs in September. Jordan Spieth. So Thomas just won all year long. I mean, he had a great, consistent year. Plus, he had 12 top 10s. He and Jordan both had 12 top 10s. To lead the PGA Tour in that stat. Jordan Spieth won a Pebble, then he won the Travelers later in the summer, and then he won the Open Championship. And as I mentioned, the 12 top 10. So even younger than Thomas or Jordan, Siwoo Kim is only 21, and he won the Players' Championship in May. Then you go, we were talking about him earlier, John Rahm, who's only 22. He had a spectacular year. Is ranked number 5 in the world. So then you just throw in, for the heck of it, you got Hideki, you got Brooks Koepka, and then you got Xander Schauffele, and all those guys are under 30 and won on tour this season. Plus, you know, they are 3 young guys that you're just going to have to watch going forward. They could do very good things. Koepka especially is impressive. He's got the game and the talent to join Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, and Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy at the top. I really believe that. Koepka, I think he's kind of a dark horse. You got to watch this guy. He impressed the heck out of me at the U.S. Open. He's played well all year, especially the rest of the year here. as we've noticed in the past, with all the tournaments, it's a year-long deal now. You just don't play 15 events and go home and work on your game a little bit, you know, spend time with the kids and all that kind of thing. These guys are out there. If they're not on tour, they're flying around someplace, working for their sponsors and doing all this stuff. They know they have to do it. The old saying, you got to make hay when the sun shines. They got to do it now while they're hot. They got to make as much money as they can because you just never know when it's going to be over. So as we said in the past, it's a young man's game. These guys are ready to go when they get to the tour from college or the web.com tour, wherever they're coming from. They know they can compete and win, and they aren't afraid of the big stage. So, Carlos, one of the stretches I was looking in the heart of the season, over an eight-week stretch from the St. Jude Classic to the Open Championship, every winner was under the age of 30. So, it's a young man's game. They dominated this year on tour. 30 wins out of 53 events. Guys under 30, and they just keep coming. But I do like the guys we got at top right now with Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, and hopefully Dustin Johnson can keep playing well. We can get Rory back. It's good stuff, Carlos, all the way.
I just want to say one thing that I forgot to tell everybody is that, let's go for who and what to watch for. I want to know, like you're saying, and we talked before about the President's Cup, is will the U.S. continue its dominance that they showed there? Was it a fluke? Was it just that internationals didn't play that well? Or is it that they're just as good as they showed there? The U.S., if something of a proven point here is that the U.S. had 33 of those 53 wins. So that's by 23 different players. Australia and Japan had 4 wins each. Japan, of course, the 4 wins came by one player. That's Hideki Matsuyama. Australia by 3, which was 2 by Mark Leishman. They have 1 by Rod Pampling. And the other one was by Cameron Smith. So that gives you some. Canada had 2 wins. Spain had 2, Sergio and John Ram. Sweden had 2, Jonas Blix and Henrik Stenson. South Korea with 1, with Siwoo Kim, and Venezuela with Jonathan Vegas. So Adam Hadwin, and Mackenzie Hughes had the 2 Canadian wins. So that tells you that the U.S. had more than half, by far, of the wins. If you come to see about that, the internationals had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of the other countries, and the other ones from Europe that won were only Spain and Sweden. So even if you extrapolate that to the Ryder Cup, it would be interesting to see how the Europeans fare next year or any outside, because the U.S. definitely dominated here. That's one of the things that I want to watch. I want to see if it's continuing the U.S. dominance. Would it continue to be a young guy's game, like you said, because 2 seasons ago, 2014 to 2015, we saw the same trend when Jordan Spieth dominated the year and won 2 majors and really showed the way for the 20-somethings, but then came 2 seasons where the 20-somethings were the ones to win 16 and 15, and now they jumped all the way to 30, which was a record. Would they continue? Would Justin Thomas, would Jordan Spieth continue to be doing that? I mean, we saw now, like you mentioned, there's also, Jason Day still in his 20s, Ricky Fowler, Rory McIlroy, add to that Xander Schauffele, Brooks Koepka. There's a lot of young guys there that can really stick, and Hideki Matsuyama, of course, to see if they are going to continue that 20-something record that happened this year. Players that I want to watch, I want to see how Justin and Jordan follow up this year. I would like to see the bounce of Jason Day, Rory McIlroy, and Dustin Johnson come up and play the way that they have to. They were really off of their games because of injuries. So Dustin Johnson, definitely, Rory McIlroy, and Jason Day, I think that if they're on, they can challenge anybody, and they can be as good as anybody as well. Some of the other players, of course, I would like to see how Hideki Matsuyama finally bounces back for after he revealing, because I don't know if that had something to do with his fade late in the year, because it happened at the same time. He revealed that he was married and he had a daughter, and then all of a sudden, boom, I don't know if he got a lot of press back there in Japan, because that's where they really got the whole attention for him, because otherwise here it was like, oh, okay, congratulations to you, keep playing. But I don't know what's going on with him. He definitely had shown that he had played, he can play with them. About the Xander Schauffele, I've always said that I think he's going to be challenging there next year. And Rookie of the Year, I'm going to tell you after I see all the ones that are going to be officially the Rookies of the Year, the Rookies, okay, I don't have the list right now. But I want to see the full list when they publish it, and then I'll tell you, because this is the first year.
I don't know who's labeled.
Yeah, who's labeled.
Kind of who's labeled.
I don't want to. Yeah, after this one, I don't know. I mean, it's the first one. As you all know, I had picked the Final Four, so until this one, that wasn't official. I'm going to look for soon I will. But that's what I want to see. I want to see if the majors, if we still have repeat winners, or are we going to keep seeing a lot of first-time winners? Because we had that streak that was broken by Jordan Spieth, but, hey, it was Sergio Brooks and Justin who won their first. Would it happen again? What are you looking forward to, Fred?
Well, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, I've been talking about these same guys, but Justin Thomas and Dustin Johnson just have a huge advantage over these other guys. They hit it so long, and they hit it fairly straight. And then you can, when if he's healthy, you can also add Rory into the list. So those guys, I love watching them play. When they're on, they are very difficult to beat. John Rahm, not afraid to win. I expect him to continue his good play into next year. I question Hideki. Can he get his mental game back to be the winner we saw late, you know, last fall and earlier this year? And then, you know, Jordan probably has the best all-round game of the young guys, or even the older guys for that matter, but his lack of distance means he has to find fairways to accommodate his irons in the green. If he's having a bad week driving the ball, it's tough for him to compete, but his short game usually allows him to be near the top 10 every week. So the other thing I really want is I want Rory to get healthy and start the year healthy and compete with Jordan and Justin and Dustin. I want to watch those four guys going head-to-head, or two of them every week or whatever. That's what I kind of want to see, Carlos. And I pulled up some stats here. I thought I'd run through these real quick. On the money list, Justin Thomas topped that with $9.9 million. Plus, you add to that the $10 million FedEx Cup, so he won almost $20 million in prize money. He had the 5 wins and 12 top 10s. Jordan Spieth was very close. I didn't realize he was this close. He ended up with $9.4 million, so he was only $500,000 behind, only $500,000. And then he also had the 12 top 10s. Dustin Johnson had $8.7 million. Hideki had $8.3 million. John Rahm, $6.1 million. He had 11 top 10, so he was close. And Ricky Fowler was sixth on the list at $6 million with 10 top 10. So there's your top six on the money list. And then, as I mentioned, the top 10 finishes, Jordan and Justin both had 12, Rahm, Ricky Fowler. And then Paul Casey popped in there at number 5 with 9. So scoring out average, Jordan Spieth had 68.8, Ricky was at 69, and Justin was at 69.3. So there again, Jordan and Justin pop up there as, you know, two of your best players in the top three. And then there's one more interesting statistic that I found today. There's all kinds of statistics if you bang around the PGA Tour website. But here, I really like this one. percentage of potential money won. So Dustin Johnson, you know, had to take some weeks off, but in the tournaments that he played in, the total purses were $31 million. Well, he won 8.7 of that, so he won 28% of the possible money he could have won, okay? And that was high. And I want to say, and I don't know this, I didn't look this up officially, but I think Tiger, when he played, of the money that was available to win, I think he won about 35%, something like that. I don't hold me to that, but I think it's around that number. Jordan Spieth was very close to Dustin Johnson. He won 27 with his 9.4 million. That was 27% of the 34 million that was possible for him to win. Justin Thomas was next with his 9.9, was 25% of the total purse. Hideki was right there with 22%, and then Ricky, again, was number five with 21%. So these names keep popping up, Jordan and JT and also Dustin Johnson. And even though Johnson missed, a fair amount of time, about a month or so, 5-6 weeks, he still had a fantastic year. So, Carlos, to wrap it up for me, it was a very good year on the PGA Tour. We loved talking about it. We can't wait to talk about 2017-2018. And we just hope that Rory gets back and at full go so we can see some good head-to-head competition with Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Dustin Johnson, and Rory McIlroy.
Definitely. With that, we'll wrap up our practice range. Hope you enjoyed it, and we're going to definitely follow up on what to look forward as we go more and delve more into more deeper into this new season. Now let's go for the very important guest, the VIG of the week. His name is Derek Brody. He's the Inverness Club Head Professional. So, Fred, tell us a little bit about this interview.
Yeah, Carlos, there's actually two people. It's Derek Brody, who is the head pro at Inverness, and also golf course architect Andrew Green. And they talk about the renovation at historic Inverness Club in Toledo ahead of the 2019 U.S. Junior Amateur that's coming up and the 2021 Solheim Cup that will be here. The Inverness Club was opened in 1903. It was first designed and built by local golf enthusiasts. Then Donald Ross was commissioned to do the final design about 1918-1919, ahead of the 1920 U.S. Open. Ted Ray won that historic tournament over his good buddy Harry Vardon, plus a young Bobby Jones made his inaugural U.S. Open appearance in Toledo that year. In 1957, Jack Nicklaus played in his first U.S. Open at Inverness. In 1986, Bob Tway holed a sand shot at the 72nd hole to beat Greg Norman. And then Norman had to settle for runner-up again to Paul Azinger in 1993 in that PGA Championship. So they've not had many majors here in the past 20 years. The course has fallen to the demands of the high-tech and the modern golf game. And however, it was in dire need of updating. Head professional Derek Brody has led a group to create a master plan for the club, and Andrew Green was hired to renovate the course but maintain the Donald Ross heritage. So, Carlos, that kind of sets it up, and we talk a little bit about what Green is doing to get it up to date and so that Inverness can try and get a U.S. Open or a PGA Championship back in here again.
Okay, let's play that interview. Okay, we're having some technical difficulties. Let's see if we can get it one more time. Hold on here. Oh, my goodness gracious. This happens when we're going live, of course. It wouldn't happen any other time. Let's try this again.
Well, we might have to hold it for another day.
No, just let's do this. Hold on. Let's try this one last time before we actually... Oh, interesting. Okay, let's do the final putts, and that'll give me a little bit of time to try to see if we can get it here done.
You want me to start mine?
Yeah, start yours, please. No problem. Thank you.
Okay, I will do it. The United States Golf Association announced last week that the U.S. Women's Mid-Amateur that was originally slated for Quail Creek Country Club in Naples, Florida, had been relocated to Champions Golf Club in Houston, Texas, and slated for November 11th through the 16th. So they moved it out a month and moved it over to Houston. And then that was because of the Irma, the hurricane, and all that good stuff. It just washed the golf course out, couldn't do it down there. A Canadian town, well, spokesman for the town of Oakville in Ontario, Canada, said the town council refused a development application by Glen Abbey owner Clublink to develop the land. The council voted in August in favor of proceeding with a notice of intention to designate the Glen Abbey property as significant cultural heritage landscape under Section 29 of the Ontario Heritage Act. This notice, also filed in August, is the first of a number of steps the town of Oakville needs to take before the designation is finalized. Clublink wants to develop the Glen Abbey property. They want to put 141 houses, 299 townhouses, 2,700 apartments, retail, and office space, as well as parks and all that kind of stuff out there. The Clublink property is home to the Glen Abbey Golf Course, and that's the home of the Canadian Open. It's been held there 28 times. Jack Nicklaus's line, pretty nice looking golf course. That's the one where Tiger hit the iron out of the bunker from, I don't know, what, 260 yards or something. It was an unbelievable shot. And then the 2018 Web.com tour schedule was released. They're going to have 27 events totaling $18.3 million in purses. They're going to feature, they're going to be in 18 states, four countries. Culminate with the four-event Web.com Tour Finals again in August and September. 27 events is the most they've ever had on the Web.com Tour. And, of course, the $18.3 million is the most also. And season-long chase for 50 available PGA Tour cards is the 23 regular season events that runs, that starts in the Bahamas, and they go to South America, and they end up with the championship again at Atlantic Beach in Florida. 12 events will air on Golf Channel, including all four Web.com Tour Finals tournaments. The Web.com Tour will be seen in 180 other countries and territories, reaching a potential 300 million households across 36 channels outside the U.S. via the PGA Tour's international broadcasting operation. Carlos, that's all the final putts I have. Where are you at?
I am at the interview, so let's try it one more time.
Okay. We are very happy to have Andrew Green from Green Golf and Turf, who's been doing some great work with renovation golf course design at Inverness Club as well as other clubs around the country. Plus, Derek Brody, the head pro at Inverness Club in Toledo. Gentlemen, welcome to the Back Nine Report.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred.
Andrew, I'm going to start with you this morning. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about your background and how you got involved with golf course design?
Came to the game kind of late middle school, high school kind of timing. Was introduced to the game by my next-door neighbor, of all people. And by the time I was a junior in high school, I kind of decided that this is what I wanted to do. So I pursued 2 degrees at Virginia Tech, one in turf and one in landscape architecture. And really never looked back. I spent 14 years doing renovation work with McDonald & Sons, a renovation contractor. And I guess it was in 2014, decided it was time for me to hang my own shingle and go out on my own.
Looking at some of your background, you've done some fairly impressive works thus far. You did some work at the Tyrol Club in Jamaica. You just did some work at Oak Hill, and now the Inverness job.
Yeah, it's been a great ride. You know, I credit a lot of that to my time learning pretty much all the different aspects of the game and understanding what it means to move dirt and what each line I draw represents on the ground, and then really worked hard on studying the history of the game and each course that I come across really trying to become an expert on that property and study the history, how the golf courses came to be, how they've changed over time, and then use all of that information to make good decisions in doing renovation and restoration work.
They were telling me yesterday that you actually, before you even came for the interview, you went to the USGA Museum, to the golf house, did some research, pulled out some old pictures from way back at the beginning of the club that they didn't even know existed.
Yeah, I take a lot of pride in doing that research. It's something that really excites me. And, sometimes you're even doing research on one project and you find something that you would have never thought you'd find on something else. And it's kind of a constant education process. And the old guys, they got it right. So all the old information, all the old articles written by these great architects, you just can glean so much. And it's just amazing to me that, 100 years later, a lot of their words and the drawings, they just speak so clearly to the game of golf even today. It's amazing stuff.
And the Inverness Club in Toledo has such a rich history. It's hosted 4 U.S. Opens, 2 PGA Championships, 2 U.S. Senior Opens, plus the U.S. Amateur in 1973, and it's also going to be the site for the 2019 U.S. Junior Amateur and the 2021 Solheim Cup. So, Derek, with all this stuff coming down the road, and I know you've been involved with this project from the very beginning, how did this fairly aggressive project come about?
It's been very exciting. Finishing up my 5th season here at Inverness, and this golf course just really impresses me day after day. I mean, I fall in love with it more every year, every month, every day, and we're excited about the 2019 U.S. Junior to have the best juniors in the world here. We're excited about the Solheim Cup coming here and really showcase this property. It's been here for a long time. There's a rich history. And board, the Greens Committee, superintendent, myself, the general manager, we just really felt, having such a historic piece of property, we really needed some sort of long-term plan to continue to work on the course as the game's evolved, as conditions have changed. So went through a long, extensive master plan kind of process, interview process, interviewed a lot of top architects, and it's been a lot of fun to see Andrew come here, see the property, share his thoughts, pick his brain, see his insight, and we're really excited about the golf course and what it's going to become over the next year and beyond.
Andrew, had you been on property at Inverness before you came to interview and look at the course? And what were your first impressions of Inverness?
Yeah, I stepped foot on the property for the first time for a preliminary interview. Now, obviously, I'd known the golf course, seen it on TV, had studied it a little bit even before knowing that I had this kind of opportunity. When I stepped foot on the property, I have to admit that I was just completely blown away by the topography and the way Ross utilized it. Just, it's incredible. To think about the simplicity of the plains, the high ground, and then you intersect that with these wonderful kind of canyons with the Inverness, the little streams and creeks that run through. It just creates a wonderful opportunity to play exciting golf, and it really speaks to the way Ross used the ground without a bulldozer and created something so special.
Andrew, I understand you were able to recreate several holes to the original Ross design that had changed or been altered over the years, and a couple holes have been lost completely, and you're able to recreate those and put those back into the routing.
Yes, that's correct. So there were 4 holes that were modified in the 70s. Those were 6, 7, and 8, and 13. And we were able to look at the old historical documentation, which for a club of this age is just spectacular. And to think the first U.S. Open in 1920, there was a tremendous amount of photography that was taken at that event and around that, and as well as the 31 Open. So we used those pictures to recreate pretty much all of those original greens that were lost, we utilized photography to recreate those. Obviously, the ground is a little bit different that we've utilized, but we really worked hard to try to get the spirit of those original Ross holes back on property.
And you feel pretty confident that you're able to restore and maintain the integrity of the Ross design, but bring the finished product up to standards of the modern game, especially from the length. And I understand you're also adding quite a bit of length to the course.
It's pretty stunning to think a course that was, at least as it sits now, was pretty much established in 1919, to find enough available property to go ahead and lengthen it out to more of a kind of a quote-unquote modern standard. The club was blessed with a little additional ground along the perimeter, and that even though the holes are fairly close together, there's opportunity to expand on the holes on and off throughout the entire property. So we've also worked to get fairway bunkers in the best locations possible so that we're challenging the better player and allowing the higher handicap golfers a little more room to negotiate down the fairway.
And, Derek, I know Andrew alluded to it there, but by adding these holes and kind of stretching it out a little bit, you've also increased the flow for a golf fan experience. You were telling me that there's some great intersections out there where you can stand, maybe see three or four holes at one time, and be able to move about the golf course for a large tournament.
Yeah, we do have a large property, and we've been opening up some view lines, and there's some spectacular spots where you can see multiple holes, you know, almost little mini amphitheaters throughout the grounds. And then you alluded to the flow. We really do feel like the flow is going to be much better than what we've had the last, you know, 35, 40 years. Andrew's really done a nice job of creating these natural, easy-flowing walks. So just on an everyday basis, we really feel like it's going to make a lot more sense.
Derek, one more question. I'll let you guys get on about your day. But, you know, tour pros, when they come in, they always complain about something. And several major events have been held at Inverness Club in the past. From a professional golfer standpoint, what do you feel the tour pros will think about Inverness after the changes, and what maybe are some of the things they're going to like?
You know, we're definitely recapturing some green space that we've lost over the years. I mean, Inverness has always been known to have very small greens, and with modern-day green speeds, we really have a tough time finding hole locations out there. So I think, you know, with the recapturing some of those green spaces that we've lost, we're going to have some opportunities for some great hole locations, some variety for the players, which you'll really love. We're very excited. We have, you know, three Ross par threes that are going in there, and they're gonna play three different wind directions. You know, one thing that we're excited about in the past, the par threes have played primarily west to east, and I think they're really gonna like the you know, variety of holes, variety of greens, variety of challenge out there. They're really gonna enjoy it. So it's a great golf course, a fun golf course, and it's not tricked up, it's not gimmicky. They've been fans in the past, and they'll continue to enjoy it even more. I'm confident of that.
Well, guys, we want to thank you so much. We've been talking with Andrew Green from Green Golf and Turf Design Company. I know you're going to be hearing more about Andrew Green in the future, and also Derek Brody, the head pro at Inverness Club in Toledo. Guys, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Fred. Thank you, Fred.
There you have it. That was Inverness Club head professional Derek Brody and golf course architect Andrew Green. So, Fred, you knew this before. You just couldn't tell us. But great changes in store there for the junior amateur and the 2021 Solheim Cup, and you will have front seat to all of them.
We've known about this for a long time, and the Inverness Club did not want anything made public until just recently. They made the formal announcement. And I'm actually having a picture of Andrew Green and the Inverness Club that is on the cover of the October issue of Ohio Golf Journal coming out next week, and a four-page article about the renovation and Andrew and a little bit of history of the club. So It's a big deal right here in Toledo and really for Northwest Ohio and this whole area that Inverness is such an iconic golf course and that they can host these kind of events. And they really want, they really are trying to get a U.S. Open back here. And I have it on good information that they will get a U.S. Open. It might not be the 2027 one. It might be. We're not sure yet. But they're definitely going to get a PGA Championship in here down the road. And it looks like they will get a U.S. Open also in the not-too-distant future.
Well, there you have it. And now I'm going to go to my final putts count in Bay Park among the notable LPGA players that will not compete for the remainder of the season. She has struggled with a nagging back injury and announced that she won't return this season, giving herself time to rest and recover. Inby said the injury occurred at the Ricoh Women's British Open, and she aggravated it while traveling to Canada. She did not play in the season's final major, which was the Evian Championship. She might play the KB Financial Group Star Championship on the Korean LPGA Tour in mid-October, but no final decision has been made, and more likely, she might feel the pressure to play on it because it's on home soil, but first, is her health. And on my last spot, Ernie Els, a four-time major champion and member of the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2010 and founder of the Els for Autism Foundation since 2009, will be the recipient of the 2018 Old Tom Morris Award from the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America. You know, the GCSAA's highest honor, the Old Tom Morris Award, has been presented annually since 1983 to an individual who, through a lifetime commitment to the game of golf, has helped to mold the welfare of the game in a manner and style exemplified by Old Tom Morris. Morris was a four-time Open Championship winner and was a longtime superintendent at the St. Andrews in Scotland until his death in 1908. You know that Ernie is known as the Big Easy because of his stature and fluid golf swing, but his significant contributions on and off the golf course are so many we would need a whole segment to discuss. Fred, he's as deserving as any other previous winner, and he's an example of what a golf and people ambassador should be, so congratulations to him in receiving this very deserving award. Any final words, Fred, before we close the show?
Yeah, I just want to say that the Els has the Els family has done a fantastic job with the foundation. I work a little bit with the First Tee here in town. I'm pretty close with them, and they are an Ernie Els autistic program here in town that's tied in with the Ernie Els Foundation for Autism in Florida. And that whole program is outstanding. I've talked to the guys who have been down to their training down there at their new facility. It's really wonderful. And, Carlos, we just missed out yesterday. Ernie was supposed to be here in town yesterday, but at the last minute he canceled out, ended up going out to San Francisco to see his daughter instead. And we would have been able to get an interview with him and talk about the President's Cup and all that good stuff. But that was not to be. Craig Stadler and Richard Beam were in town. Rich Beam were in town yesterday. I talked to them for a minute. I didn't get an interview with him, but I did talk to him for a minute. And I really just want to kind of tease just a little bit here. We have a really outstanding interview coming for next week. As you know, we announced last week that Renee Powell, who is from East Canton, Ohio, will be inducted into the PGA of America's Hall of Fame later this year. And we had a chance to meet Ms. Powell last week, and I got an interview with her, and I have to tell you, it was one of the most enjoyable interviews I've ever done, and I can't wait to play it next week, Carlos.
There you have it, Back Niners. That will wrap up another week of the Back Nine Report. Thank you for listening. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Special thanks to our VIGs, very important guests of the week, Derek Brody and Andrew Green. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Block Talk Radio. Or if you missed it, check it out on iTunes or tune in. Also, watch us on Roku TV. And if you haven't done so, follow us. on Twitter. Our ID is at Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres, along with Fred Alvader. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Wednesday is the new night for the Blacklist. Then, on SVU, Benson is accused of the unthinkable. And on Chicago PD, it's a race to catch a bomber who could be one of their own. Tonight on NBC.
Tonight, the deal that's costing North Texas taxpayers $2 million.
They turn around and pass that expense on to us without our prior approval. It's pretty appalling.
An agency in trouble quietly passing costs. What taxes meant for your children really paid for. Tonight.
Wednesday is the new night for the Blacklist. Then, on SVU, Benson is accused of the unthinkable. And on Chicago PD, it's a race to catch a bomber who could be one of their own. Tonight on NBC.
Tonight, the deal that's costing North Texas taxpayers $2 million.
They turn around and pass that expense on to us without our prior approval. It's pretty appalling.
An agency in trouble quietly passing costs. What taxes meant for your children really paid for. Tonight.